Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. I'm Ron, the host and moderator of this podcast, which you will find on the web at myrecoverycast.com. There are links there to all previous episodes, as well as information and links that will help you to subscribe to the podcast using your favorite app if you wish to do so. My co-host, Dave, and I were honored in this episode to have had the opportunity to sit down for an interview with Franny J., the current World Board Chair, and Anthony E., the Executive Director of NA World Services. They spoke to us from the World Service Office, where they were in the middle of the final board meeting before the World Service Conference coming up in Woodland Hills, California, April 24th through the 30th. We talked about the upcoming conference, and while we had their ear, we talked about a wide range of other topics. When we refer to the CAR in the early going, we mean the conference agenda report, a report distributed within the fellowship before each conference to help the groups prepare to give guidance to their regional delegates who will be attending the conference. The CAR contains a number of essays and discussions, as well as a set of motions that will be introduced during the business sessions of the conference.
We're in the conference season now, and Anthony, you probably have not been out to any CAR workshops.
That's correct.
Okay, but Franny, you've been out there. How many CAR workshops have you been to?
I've been to 3 CAR workshops.
Okay, so what's on people's mind out there? What are the hot issues?
Well, the hot issues are really interesting this year. One is, why would the World Board make one motion that has 3 parts in it and not 3 separate motions? And that's motion 2. And that blew my mind, because I think the reality of it is it's one little paragraph in a guide to World Services. And it made no sense in my mind at the time we were proposing it to make it 3 motions.
Motion 2 in the conference agenda report proposes 3 changes to the size and composition of the board itself. The first part is to change the size of the board from its current maximum of 18 members to a proposed new maximum of 15 members. The board has stated their belief that this would improve the effectiveness of the board and be more financially sustainable. The second change relates to term length. The standard term length for board members is 6 years, but under the current policy, if more than 8 members are elected at a given conference, new members draw straws to see whose terms will be shortened in an effort to even out the number of members that roll off at any one time. Citing the steep learning curve for board members, the board is proposing to eliminate that practice, leaving all terms at 6 years regardless. And the third part of the motion is a change in the term limit policy for board members. The policy says that a board member may only serve 2 consecutive terms. The board is proposing that any one person only be eligible to serve 2 terms, or 12 years, in a lifetime. The board bundled these 3 changes into a single motion. If the conference decides to take up each separately, then it will first have to act to separate them or divide the question and then act on each one individually.
And then I think the other things are just there's a lot of speculation as what are the motives behind some of the regional motions. And I don't know that that's consistent across the country or across the world. A lot of folks thought that they sounded personal, and some of them didn't really carry a worldwide interest. And so there was some real diverse discussion about the regional motions.
There are a total of 14 motions in the CAR. 2 of them are made by NA World Services. Motion 1, which proposes the approval of the newly developed full-length book called Guiding Principles, The Spirit of Our Traditions, and Motion 2, which was just discussed. The remaining 12 motions are made by regions. A number of these propose new limits on the board's role and participation in the conference, or would dramatically reduce the board's financial resources by requiring changes to the packaging and pricing of certain literature.
There seemed to be great support for the completion of the Traditions book project. I haven't heard anything all that negative out there about it. It seems to be well embraced by the fellowship. Some communities are saying they want to start using it now. Other communities want to know when the release date is. And of course, we have to tell them if it gets approved, it'll be sometime this year.
What about fellowship development stuff? And interesting developments in the fellowship out there in the world?
We took advantage of a public relations opportunity to do a fact-finding trip to Vietnam. That was a result of relationships that were established at a previous public relations conference in Japan a year previous, and the opportunity to meet some physicians who were responsible for the lives of a great many addicts in Vietnam, who extended an invitation almost casually, and that turned into a formal invitation to meet with the representative physician from the United States Embassy in Hanoi, who has been charged with the HIV intervention program, which is funded by the United States. And part of the HIV intervention program is dealing with the rampant substance abuse problem amongst people who were HIV infected. So we were encouraged to visit to see if there was a viability for Narcotics Anonymous in the settings that they currently have, which are right now all methadone clinics. There really is no or much external treatment, as was explained to us. The government, or at least these facilities in Hanoi, deal with about 15,000 addicts a day on average. As a result of this opportunity, we had a section of the institutional group guide translated into Vietnamese along with IP number 1, IP number 7. We just completed recovery and relapse because recidivism is a tremendous problem in this community, and got a casual agreement to try to create a couple of institutional NA meetings according to the guide in one or two of the Hanoi-based methadone clinics. So we were excited, given that we only went to really try to get information, the reception that we received and the opportunity that addicts might be able to be introduced to our message as part of the formal system of dealing with them by the government was encouraging.
That sounds great. It seems like the pattern in Asia is often expats first, and the expat communities get something going, and then they begin to try to work to get something going among the locals and in their own language and that sort of stuff. Is there a pattern like that in Vietnam?
There was. For many years, there was a member who was an expat who tried to keep a roving meeting going in Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon, what used to be referred to as Saigon. But up until recently, it was against the law for addicts or anyone to meet. So it always had to be a clandestine kind of meeting. And as a result, was usually rotated through a restaurant or two that people had just come to know that if there was going to be a meeting, that's where it would be a particular time of day. That particular person, that particular member, is no longer in Vietnam. There is a local member that is of service and trying to facilitate making our message available. But the changes in the government's attitudes about decriminalizing being an addict are recent. And so everybody, the physicians, our member and everybody's trying to figure out what is that actually going to mean? Because there's still a lot of locally based law enforcement, and the message about the decriminalization has not necessarily filtered all the way down into the community. So I think that addicts still would be reticent to meet publicly, which is what made the possibility of institutional meetings and methadone clinics a much more exciting proposition.
Anthony, did they seem receptive to our message of abstinence-based recovery?
The physicians were, you know, we had an opportunity to talk to some of the methadone center clients while we were there. It was, you know, people that they had arranged for us to talk to. So in at the facility, I believe that it was honest and straightforward. But, you know, again, they were people who were stuck in a room and made accessible to us. I think the thing that they talked about was the need to have some different approach to conveying principles to people to live by, drug-free, because that's not a concept that is particularly well understood.
Yeah. And is it really methadone, or is it Suboxone, or are you speaking generically, or is it actually methadone?
No, actually, I believe they are actually dispensing methadone.
Okay. That pamphlet that you guys just came out with, or that is in the process right now of being reviewed, I thought was outstanding. It has a good feel to it that it seems to walk that path clearly on both sides of that issue, one side being, you know, we are an abstinence-based program, and methadone, Suboxone may be a method of getting clean, not a method of being clean, I guess is I'm using my own language.
Well, I think that's pretty commonly held, and some of our members are much more rigid over these issues than others, which I believe some of the more recent pamphlets that have been created that address some of these issues have been more intended to focus on the third tradition element of our welcoming program as opposed to stringent criteria. So I believe we have, as you indicated, struck an excellent balance between the conveyance of our principal philosophy and the realization of how the world is dealing with addicts today.
Yeah.
Will that be, what is the track for that piece that I've read it? Will that come up at the conference?
The PR piece that you read?
Yes.
The professionals. In 2008, the conference gave some authority to the board to produce pamphlets just with a 90-day input for changes. So it's not about, it won't be recovery literature. It'll be a public relations tool for us to use when communicating with the medical professions so that they can see that there is a viable resource in our communities.
Yeah. I couldn't let this opportunity go without just saying I liked the pamphlet in large part. I had a problem with one sentence that warned doctors that they their patients may run into intolerance at certain meetings. Yes. I had a problem with that use of that word. It seemed like we were warning professionals that certain of our members are intolerant, and I thought it was very subjective because what one person may see as intolerance might really just be a particular group having making a real effort to be clear with someone coming through the door that we are abstinence-based.
I really urge you to send that in writing so that it gets considered, because certainly, you know, everybody's input's going to be considered that we get on this. We often will take a look at a piece and I don't remember what the turnaround time is. I went out with the cat, so it's about 90 days. And then I would just send in any input. Okay. Anyone who has those concerns, just send in the input because, again, we want to make sure that it's got a fresh read over.
Well, it also, we need to be, I think, careful to recognize that one of the biggest complaints we have received from physicians over the last several years has been the reality that their patients come back and complain about how individual groups may choose to express their belief about complete abstinence. So it just, for the lack of, in some ways, because we were aiming a tool specifically at professionals, I think that had a lot to do with why that word was utilized.
I hear you. But it struck me as, again, we're speaking to an audience outside the fellowship and warning them about what someone feels is negative behavior within the fellowship. And I had a problem with that.
All right. And the approval method, this is a, as I understand it, this is a service pamphlet, which means ultimately it's board approved after a period of 90-day review by the conference participants, but not approved by the conference, correct?
It will be PR materials. So it won't be like the blue and white service pamphlets that the World Board does. It will be World Board approved, but it will be a service tool to use in PR presentations and communications.
Oh, so it's not, it won't fall under the heading service pamphlet.
That's my belief.
Okay. But essentially it's in the same niche in that it's board approved material.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So that was Vietnam. Is there any follow-up kind of stuff with Vietnam?
Well, you have to, I think one of the bitter lessons we learned when we went through the resource crunch years ago was an effort without a planned follow-up is pretty fruitless. So yes, there is a follow-up scheduled for between the third and fourth calendar quarter of this year, just to see the progress with trying to institute the one or two institutional groups, and you know, kind of what the impact of that has been.
Yeah, in fact, that takes me back a bit to the Arabic-speaking Middle East, where there were a couple of workshops with follow-ups there. The plan was to follow up every couple of years, which I believe was done. And is that still going on?
You have to. If you want to have value from the investment of the fellowship's resources in these developmental efforts, you have to integrate some form of reasonable follow-up so that you don't just set the community back to where it was before you ever had the original requested interface. So now I'd say as a standard, follow-up is a part of any planned development for especially emerging NA communities.
And that seems like the workshops that you did in Russia and in the Russian-speaking part of Eastern Europe, where it seems to me at this point, were phenomenally successful in that they connected people to each other. And then that synergy begins to happen, and you have the kind of explosive growth you've seen in the Russian fellowship.
Yeah, I think that there is a direct correlation between a planned effort and then a reasonable follow-up and then an evolutionary plan. And by evolutionary, I don't mean that you plan out the evolutionary development of a community. You accept the premise that the community is going to grow and develop over time, and you find ways to continue to follow up as that process of evolution is occurring.
Where else is this? Where would you say the emerging fellowship is really popping right now?
Well, I think you'd have to look at Africa. Certainly with the advent of the East Africa Convention, which I think created a standard kind of place to do an interface, that resulted in eventually the creation of, as a result of people's attendance and our interaction with individuals from communities other than where the convention was, it was a central opportunity to bring people together from differing communities so that they could interact with each other in many instances for the first time. That has resulted in the creation of an African zone. The kind of development of a service body now that is made up of representatives of the communities wherein they exist in Africa.
Okay, so that's just, that pot is just stirring right now. The connections are being made. And I mean, NA has been flourishing in South Africa for some time.
Yes, for a very long time.
Yeah. And we've just begun the process of making some contacts there to put together an episode on the African Zone and that story. So there'll be more.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. I remember when it was that area where it was a little disheartening because you knew the need was great, but the successes were small. And it's so great to see it starting to pop now.
Yeah, absolutely. It was one of the biggest blanks on our fellowship meeting map. You remember that we used to post up at the World Service Conference every year, and there was always a big gray blob when you started looking at the African continent, because with the exception of the very south and in those early days, the very north, of the African continent, the middle was pretty much all gray. So you're actually starting to see development happening in communities and fellowships that are excited about the Narcotics Anonymous message and the ability to have Narcotics Anonymous in their communities.
Yeah, that's great. And then, you know, there's a couple of communities that were emerging at one point and then really took off and are now becoming pretty well-developed, very large enough fellowships to begin talking about their own zone and that sort of stuff. I guess I would put Brazil and Russia in that category.
Yeah.
Lots of excitement going on there, too. I noticed Russia making a splash in the car this year.
Yes.
And I, you know, it, somehow it warms the cockles of my heart in a way to say, you know, as the U.S. fellowship started finding its legs, you'd start to find some, what would you say, flashpoints of disagreement and people asserting themselves in ways that created conflict, and not necessarily bad conflict, the kind of conflict that just comes from growth. And now we're seeing some of those challenges coming from outside the U.S., which is sort of exciting. I guess you could say it's a hallmark of growth in a way.
Well, that certainly seems to be true in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And it might be the example that they, you know, that they follow. That seems to be the way that regions kind of find out where they stand inside the World Service Conference.
Yeah. One of the topics that I kind of had on my mind is the topic of conference seating and the future of the World Service Conference. And I know Dave comes from a portion of the fellowship that's not currently seated at the conference. And so, Dave, why don't you take the lead and we'll get started.
Yeah, I will. Actually, that Marvick, now I took the microphone at the end, and you know, I hope you, and not in a non-confrontational way, voiced some of the frustration that we feel living in a region that is not seated. And I guess we broke away from another region about 10 or 12 years ago. And the people are starting to get a bit restive about trying to have a vote. And there was a kind of last minute effort to put together something to impact, figure out, could we align ourselves with another region for this conference? But there wasn't time. But I think what people want to hear is, are we moving toward some sort of reorganization or an overlay of organization that every addict in the world and in regions like mine can really feel good about sitting down and reading the car and doing a group conscience on it?
I'm sorry, Dave, what region are you from?
Eastern Pennsylvania. It broke off of Philadelphia.
Right. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't making an assumption. Okay.
First, I want to say a couple of things about this. I come from a background in my service experience before serving on the board, before going to my first conference, where I was the addict who sat in Little Washington State reading every single conference agenda report, never having an expectation, a hope, or a dream of getting to the conference, just wanting to know what's going on. So I hope everyone continues to read it, whether or not they're getting there, whether or not they think there's a way to get there. And I really caution us using the word voice versus vote, because I believe your voice is there, David. I believe that Eastern Pennsylvania's voice is heard, that we have enough communities that really do understand that their neighbors may not have a seat there, that some contemplation is starting to happen. I'm not saying that they go out and ask you your opinion and they carry your particular decision back, but I think that there is getting to be a much more compassionate approach to not just my way. And I'll give you an example. Some of the interest, I wish I had a crystal ball and could tell you, yes, something magical is about to happen and the conference seating issue will be resolved. But as we move into this understanding what discussion-based decision-making is, it gets a little more cumbersome as we grow in number. And part of the value of having all of those voices is that we get to see how similar they are, not how unique they are. And that's really kind of what I've been noticing over the course of my almost decade sitting there. And that's sitting there as a World Board member. Before that, I didn't see the similarities. I saw how we were not necessarily like a Californian region, even though we were in Western states. And today, sitting there, I see just too many similarities to even think that if a region made a decision to, let's say, share their vote or voice with another region, is there enough trust for that? So some interesting examples came out, and that is the Minnesota region posted an ad, and they called it Regions Seeking Regions. We are looking to not attend the conference and trust that your region will hear us, accumulate our conscience, combine it with yours, and we trust that process that much. And so I believe it's the Greater Illinois region will be taking the Minnesota conscience, and they will share a seat and be one person. And it's done with, I think, a little bit of hope that this will get modeled and a lot of trust that this process could be replicated. There's other examples that are really interesting. One of the zones had said, what if all of our regions decide just to send one RD representing all of our zones, would you allow that person to sit and call themselves all of our names and not have all those chairs? And I thought that was an interesting discussion. So I think there's some interesting, quirky things being talked about within communities. But what we're also seeing is people saying, well, I think we're going to zonal seating, so we better create a zone first. And I don't know that we're going to any particular known place by anyone. Like, we all may think we have some idea of what would best serve the conference or the fellowship, but I still think the creative ideas are still to be gnawed out and fleshed out at this next conference. And hopefully we're going to see whether it's a seed or a voice or a nod of the head. Oh, wow, my voice really is being stated right over there, that we come together on this.
Well, my impression after having spoken to Dave about this and some others, that if there was a mechanism that was, that was sort of understandable to people, by which even if you go with your assumption that at some point, it may not be a vote and a tallying of votes as so much as the kind of coming together of voices and the building of consensus that happens in a more discussion-based environment. Even if you go with that assumption, then some mechanism by which everybody can feel like they're part of it. Like, it's by virtue of this understood mechanism that my home group and my local fellowship is a part of the process. And doesn't it seem like the impediment to that is cultural within NA and historical and local, it doesn't seem to me that the impediment is coming so much from World Services as it is coming from the difficulty with the local fellowship seeing this differently.
Well, you know, Ron, one of my biggest awakenings was sitting there, I think, in 2006 or 2008, and having a conversation with the RD team from Portugal when they said, we don't have motions where I come from. That's an American thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And when I heard that, it was such an anomaly for me to even comprehend that there are communities that sit around, talk about ideas, and agree to try something without a motion, without, you know, having to make sure that nine people agree with me first, or 19, or whatever it is. So when I heard that, I thought, can the culture change? Will it? I've changed so much in the, you know, in the little bit of time that it's taken. Well, since, let me just say this, since I met you, my perception, my understanding, my delivery, my just my trust in the process has changed so much. And we've come through some really awkward things at World Services, and I still trust it that much that I believe the ultimate authority will speak through the group conscience. And the more we develop the trust in that, the more the people in the communities in that are used to things like motions or voting or tallies will come to accept that a conversation gets heard and somebody listens and presents it.
Yeah, for me, it was actually Norway. I was in, you know, in the Norway, the Scandinavian Fellowship in general, the Swedish Fellowship. These are some pretty sophisticated, well-developed fellowships in many ways. And so I went. I was a board member. I was going to do a car workshop in Norway. And so we went in the room, and of course, there many people showed up because they were excited about a conversation with the World Board and about the conference and that. So I started making my little presentation, and I said, let me just stop for a moment and get questions. And the first question was, you keep using the word motion. What is a motion? Because I would be talking about motion one, motion two. And I would start to talk about it, and it was clear, Robert's Rules, clearly a U.S., they don't operate that way at all, and as you said, much of the fellowship.
Yeah, and if you go to the APF, they have discussions that are really about, we'd like our fellowship development to go in this general area, but if a change happens, they trust that that's where they were directed to. So even though the whole community may decide we're going to work on fellowship development this term and make up a place, Saudi Arabia, there, if that doesn't pan out because it's dangerous that year or they can't get cooperation from the community within, and they may decide, oh, well, we're going to go over and do some more work in the Philippines. And they just accept that during in-between business meetings. They trust. It's not that there's never any dissent. I'm certain they have disagreement somewhere to next develop. But I was amazed at how during the course of their year between meetings they just trusted that it had to move over there because it wasn't safe to go do it there.
I remember when Steve Sigmund left NAS, and one of the points that he started to make was NAS should concentrate more on helping everybody to understand the strategic plan and the strategic planning process, because it's so central to everything. It's so central to all the decision-making. And it's not well understood at all. As you go to car workshops, they really think the conference is about this set of motions. That's what the conference is, this set of motions. And really, this set of motions is increasingly becoming a small part of what the conference is about.
I like to tell people that the regional motions or the motions in the conference agenda report take up less than 10% of the conference. And I may be wrong on the percentages because I don't do math, but I'm probably not that off. But you bring up the strategic plan, and that kind of takes us over to what's happened in the CAT this year. We made a more user-friendly kind of approach to the strategic plan so that communities could see how to start feeding into the process.
The CAT is an acronym for the Conference Approval Track. Sometime in the late 90s, during an open forum at the conference, some delegates suggested that it might be helpful to separate the conference agenda report into two separate reports. The idea was that the CAR itself would still contain materials of direct relevance to the groups, such as the approval of recovery material and other significant conference actions, and could be used at the local level to involve the fellowship in preparations for the conference. The other would contain some of the more complex or arcane business of the conference and could be used by the delegates themselves to prepare for the procedural sort of business. The hope was that the groups would be less overwhelmed or intimidated by the sheer size and complexity of the CAR. This idea percolated for a couple of years. The 1999 conference created a project called the Process for Service Material to come up with a process to revise or create various handbooks, manuals, and other service materials. One of the recommendations that came out of this project was implemented by the 2000 conference. This was to create a separate approval track for service materials called the Conference Approval Track. This was the birth of the companion to the CAR. If regions wanted to also workshop this locally, they could, but this split offered the possibility of a simpler CAR containing only the most significant conference decisions and discussions. So today, the CAT contains the budget and project plans and proposed service materials. When passed, these materials are considered conference approved. Materials in the CAR are understood to have undergone more thorough workshopping at the local level and are considered fellowship approved. In general terms, fellowship approved literature includes all recovery materials. Conference approved literature includes handbooks, guidelines, and the like. Occasionally, such as in the case of the adoption of the Guide to Local Service or the 12 Concepts, service-oriented materials have been considered of such significance as to be included in the CAR rather than the CAT, but that's the basic distinction between the two.
An ideal setting probably would be that communities would start doing planning themselves and that they would parallel their planning cycle so it would feed into the scanning process that the conference uses and have more impact on the end result, what comes out of there, the actions taken. So although some people really receive this user-friendly approach to the strategic planning outline in the CAT, it was funny because in Lancaster, we met some people who were going, just as I started figuring that thing out, you guys are changing it. How dare you? Yeah. And we really thought we were kind of speaking the language of more people by doing this shift.
Yeah, well, I can say when Freddie, who was the RD from my region, got his hands on the CAT and he read the whole thing, he spoke to me and said, just so much more user-friendly, so much more accessible. So it really kind of an exciting thing to be involved in because it was going for soliciting guidance from the fellowship in a way that seemed a lot more effective. Like, you know, that kind of goes to the spirit of, does everything have to be done with emotion, or can you solicit guidance, have a discussion that truly does guide, steer, and set the agenda? But you're not really in a kind of a parliamentary business session while doing it.
And a lot of folks were really open to that when you know, some people said, no, we don't want to make a motion. We just want to generate some discussion. And so we've opened up the CAT mailing to include regional discussions or ideas so that there's some kind of avenue. And the conference report's always been open for regional delegates to submit information or requests or ideas. And we're looking for more ways to open that discussion up long before CAR and CAT season. hopefully within the, you know, the first 6 months after a conference happens, we can start putting some mechanism in place for people to start feeding in ideas so that they can come up in discussion essays or in discussion pieces as part of the car or the cat.
Franny mentioned the conference report. This is yet a third report prepared for each conference. This is a more wide-ranging report prepared by World Services to update everyone on the state of various discussions and issues and to give the delegates some useful information to help them prepare for the conference. For many years, regions have been invited to develop essays around issues of importance to them for publication in the conference report. This option is rarely used, but is occasionally used by a region that wishes to forward a particular discussion for everyone's consideration. That's what Franny is referring to here.
Well, I think that it just bears pointing out that you know, there are a great many people who have a great many theories about what they believe is underneath whatever it is they've been able to see or been presented with, and, you know, have varying motives, which is nothing different for an eclectic group of addicts. But I think that we're seeing an evolution towards what has clearly been requested as it relates to a more discussion-based forum where people feel more able to at least participate in the development of what it is that we intend to do next. So the strategic plan redesign was really about simplification, and it was about trying to address some of the many issues we've heard from members about the level of complexity that they perceived was in the prior plans. And, you know, everything from not being able to understand it to NAWS is doing this on purpose so that we can understand it.
And so
we realize that that reality exists. And to some degree in an organization this diverse, I expect you're going to have some level of that kind of attitude pretty much about anything. Certainly, you know, as Franny indicated about the future of the WSC, there are those that believe that the World Board has it all figured out and it's sitting in a file at the WSO as it relates to a future structure. And actually, it is actually an active evolution and a process that's in stages, and at every conference it is developing to whatever it is that the conference participants themselves are drawn into a discussion to help frame the next steps of what that future is going to look like. So I think that all we can do is just, I think, keep trying to, you know, make that process as accessible as possible. And more people, I think, are buying into the idea. I mean, I think if we've all been around long enough to remember back when planning was a bad word in this organization. And now, even at our base levels of service, you have, you know, very large groups now that are planning, even at its most simple level. Areas and regions are starting to utilize some form of planning, some form of examining what they do and how they do it and trying to improve. So I think it's a very natural kind of process that's happening. And hopefully, you know, the fellowship will at this upcoming conference provide some additional direction about where it wants to go.
Yeah, it actually looks to be shaping up like possibly an exciting conference in that sense. I think of the phrase, you know, paradigm shift theory, that when there's, I guess the language of NA says when one door closes, another door opens, but the hallway right. can be a bitch, you know, that right. paradigm shift theory being when the old paradigm isn't working anymore, and you kind of have to get miserable enough in the old paradigm, the new paradigm hasn't yet formed and presented itself, and then you get in that kind of place in between where nobody's very happy with the system because you don't have the new one, you don't have the old one, and we've been in that kind of hybrid mode for a while now, I think.
Right.
I think we all as addicts know that our one of our biggest resistance is always to change and letting go.
Yeah.
So, comes into the reason for the theme of this conference, which comes from our vision statement, you know, honesty, trust, and goodwill. I think that's what we have to all start really kind of mantraing to believe that we all are here for the same purpose, that we all love Narcotics Anonymous. We want to see it survive. We want to see it grow. We want to see it reach far edges of the earth. And that's part of what we have to believe in one another.
Yeah. Boy, it kind of, it reminds me of the, no, I'm not going to go there. So, first of all, let me ask Dave. Dave, you have anything coming to mind for you that you'd like to ask or
take just on? In general, I guess, you know, I'm curious, what do you see the challenges in the future to the fellowship where, you know, what's on the horizon?
To the fellowship as a whole?
Yes.
Well, certainly the medicalization of addiction treatment is going to, I believe, have some effect on us in years to come. And I guess the way I believe that is you now have doctors who believe and pharmaceutical companies who are pursuing a cure for addiction. So I think that, you know, I guess I'm being part pessimist here and, you know, expecting an announcement from one of these pharmaceutical companies about the magic bullet, that pill that will cure addiction. And given that we have described addiction as it relates to our program as a disease, we may have to find a way to differentiate better than we have currently. So I think that's one potential challenge. And then a changing demographic in the nature of addicts all over the world. And just the real time practicality of still staying relevant in the face of all of these varying options that people are presented with every day on media and social media.
Yeah, you talk about the pill, the cure for addiction. I heard somebody in a meeting say, well, if they come up with a pill that's going to cure addiction, I wonder what two will do.
Right, yeah. Well, the nature of addiction, the nature of addicts, as we understand them, is one is too many and 1,000 never enough.
Right.
But that's not necessarily the same approach that is being utilized with some physicians and the pharmaceutical industry. I think the thing that I'm really happy about, and it's one of the things we found out about in Vietnam, we were informed that the American Society for Addiction Medicine, which is the certifying agency for physicians that are identified as addictionologists, now has a part of their criterion that a physician must be familiar with the principles of Narcotics Anonymous as part of the exam. I was really happy to hear that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. I was
that's,
really
happy. That's first I've heard that. That's exciting.
So, I,
go ahead.
No. I just think, again, you know, the natural tendency of our society seems to be that medical innovation can have a unintended consequence for entities or people in an effort to cure this thing that every doctor believes there's a cure for. So given that addiction has been defined as a disease by the American Society for Addiction Medicine, there are physicians that now believe, obviously, there has to be a cure. So I just think that that'll be one of the issues we'll be dealing with as the future approaches.
Yeah, a cure, and another kind of corollary point there would be that if addiction is a a disease, then the treatment of it falls under their purview.
Yes.
Not so much the purview of pedestrians such as us.
Yeah. So we're fortunate because the current government officials that are responsible for creating policies actually believe in peer-based recovery. Mm. And because of that, they've kept the abstinence-based models, the community-based peer support organizations at the forefront of these discussions as the policy discussions evolve.
That's great. You know, it's another opportunity for people to just kind of talk past each other in a way, because if you're looking at the addiction as something where you have a brain chemistry situation that has you engaging in compulsive behavior, and that's the dimension of addiction that you're interested in, yeah, then you're going to say we can provide these drugs to affect brain chemistry. But if you're saying there's a mental, spiritual, psychosocial, emotional, all these dimensions to addiction that we talk about, we don't use that kind of language, but we talk about all those dimensions in NA, it just seems self-evident on the face of it that you're not going to get a pill that addresses all of that. But you can, in a fellowship of mutual support with spiritual principles, address addiction in all of its dimensions.
Yes. I mean, thankfully, we have no opinion on outside issues.
Yeah, one of the buzzwords that we've all heard out of the medical community is evidence-based practices. And that's usually, in my experience, what a doctor says when they're clicking their pen and getting ready to write a prescription. And I sit at meetings and conferences and conventions, and I look out and I go, this is an evidence-based practice. Mm. Why don't they come and see this?
Because it's not scientific. yeah. I mean, that's the simplest thing. Well, I'm telling you what many have said to us. That evidence-based, as it's being bandied about, seems to have a criterion that's attached to government policies about science. And since we don't really get engaged in those dialogues, for the very reason I stated before, we stay outside the fray of having opinions on these approaches. The reality is that there seems to be some standard of what evidence-based means. And again, we actually are benefiting from work that's being done by physicians that challenge the notion that science by itself is the solution, and that some form of community-based peer support has to be integrated into whatever solutions are being developed. And that's where we seem to get contacted about the viability of making the NA message available in some part of that model.
Yeah.
I thought the pamphlet, by the way, was very good. The public relations pamphlet addressed to physicians in reaffirming in a spiritual, gentle way that we are a program of complete abstinence.
Yes.
I thought that was very well done.
Absolutely.
You know, when I saw that, I thought there was a certain urgency among some of our members if they believe that Nas is going soft on that point, because some do. So I've never believed that. I've never seen evidence of that. But some people have believed that Nas is buying in somehow to the current trends and approaches that would say, medicate addicts with things like Suboxone, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, we would be losing our foundation as an abstinence-based program. The people fear that that's happening, and they begin to get more fierce in some of the things that the pamphlet may be characterizing as intolerance. But when the pamphlet makes it clear that we are who we are when we're an abstinence-based program, it seems like some of the urgency goes out of the fight, which I think I'm hopeful will be one of the benefits of that pamphlet.
And I think it also, even if its purpose is not to put in the hands of addicts, I think addicts will read it as it becomes available as a tool, and they'll say, perhaps there is a more tolerant approach to talking to folks who don't quite get it. And I'll give you an example, Ron. I sit in my home group, and there's a treatment center that very much uses drug replacement therapy. And the young women come in, and for a while they were really awkward about it, but they said they felt more comfortable because there are a lot of longtime women in my home group. We're not a women's group. We just simply attract a lot of longtime standing clean women addicts. And one of these young women said, somebody approached her and said, "What's your clean date?" And she said, "I'm still in the desire phase." And that approach seemed to really support her. And I just, you know, I really think we need to start taking a look at reminding them they might still be in the desire phase.
I love that. Yeah. That somebody could embrace that and not feel excluded by that, because it, as the third tradition says, if you're in the desire phase, you're in the car, you're with us, you're a member.
Yeah, I really thought that was a beautiful approach to the situation, and it certainly does close down debate about the subject, about, you know, how we talk about or welcome people who are not quite ready for complete abstinence.
Yeah. So, Anthony, what has you excited right now about your job, about NA, about NAS? Anything?
Well, I mean, I think that there's always something new as it relates to the availability of our message in a new community, the opportunity for addicts to find the same miracle that saved my life and a great many others. So I think excitement comes from that always. And that, you know, for me, it's a matter of, you know, recognizing every day that the office doesn't belong to me, you know, that I'm a steward, that I'm charged with the responsibility to maintain a stewardship over somebody else's property, and that every single day, pursuit of our vision is what we are charged with the responsibility to do. So, you know, I feel great if I'm able to make a decision that aligns with our principles and makes our message available to the addict that still suffers. You know, the need, you know, unfortunately, you know, addiction is a growth industry. And it's going to be a growth industry irrespective of how much money governments throw at it or how strict or lenient governments become about the use of drugs. The problem of addiction is going to constantly remain at what I believe to be an extremely high level. And the demand for services related to addiction is going to continue to grow and escalate globally. So I'm, you know, always excited about the possibility that, you know, some country, you know, one day is going to decide to embrace Narcotics Anonymous as a way for addicts to get and stay clean. And I remain hopeful. And, you know, there's some diehard nations out there that, you know, especially when you start talking about Asia or the Far East, where, you know, their attitudes about what to do to an addict or about an addict is to shove them away somewhere behind big concrete walls and barbed wire and leave them there. So we're starting to see some attitude shift, and that creates, you know, a hopefulness that maybe one day some of those seemingly unbreakable kinds of barriers will start to come down to access for our program. You know, I kind of always believe that, you know, if NA can grow and flourish in Iran, it could do it anywhere. And that's always kind of has been the touchstone for me for quite some time. Mm. So I remain forever hopeful that we can get better at making our message available to the addict that still suffers, and that is our principal charge.
We're coming up on an hour for this episode now, and I want to give you the whole thing. So we're going to do something differently this time. Instead of waiting 2 weeks, we'll give you a bonus edition next week, the completion of this interview. We cover more about the upcoming conference and go into other topics like translations and how that process works in NA. We discuss the realities of providing services to a global fellowship given the disparity of economic conditions around the world. We touch on partnerships with local fellowships at public relations events, and we have an extended discussion of world conventions, their successes and challenges, both logistical and financial. So there's a lot more good stuff to come in this interview. One more question to Anthony, and we'll see you next week for a special bonus edition of the Recovery Cast.
That makes me think about that, about your trip to China. Can you just tell that story a little bit? I know that's a while ago now, but it was a pretty exciting opportunity that we had.
Well, we were, again, as a result of our public relations efforts, we were extended an invitation to accompany a World Health Organization panel to the People's Republic in Beijing many years ago. The sponsors were a group of mental health professionals in the Chinese government who were desperate to try to find an alternative to their existing approaches of dealing with addicts, which was really to incarcerate 85% of people identified as addicts were put under the control of the military and incarcerated. Only 15% were allowed to be under the jurisdiction of the mental health department, where they were actually trying treatment models. And that's where we were given kind of an opportunity to do a presentation about the viability of NA in a community. But there were some inherent challenges. And the biggest one was that addicts were not particularly welcome in the community. You know, things that we take for granted, like the ability to rent a church and to have meetings and to walk around and to get employment and to get a place to live, to get somebody to rent us a place to live, those conditions don't necessarily exist in a great many places. Addicts are still, in some places, ostracized. And so as a result, the recidivism rates were at 100% because the addicts had nowhere to go. Even after they went through what they quote unquote referred to as treatment, they had to go right back to the same neighborhoods, professions, and interests that they had before they were arrested or placed into the treatment environments, which resulted in, as we know, if you go back to where you came from, you end up doing what you used to do. As it turned out, I believe was a political kind of something that was structured politically to try to convince the Chinese military to lessen its authoritative control over drug addicts. Because remember, there are still countries that execute addicts for having possession of a certain amount of controlled substances. And so they execute some number of addicts every year. And that amount is not nearly as large as some people would expect. Now, I think it's 21 grams in some countries can result in a death penalty. And so the treatment of addicts in some places is still barbaric. And in some, well, barbaric by the standards that we would apply based on our judgments and experience. So we had that experience. Several years later, there's always been an effort for the last, I want to say, I don't know, 20 years. There have been off and on efforts to have meetings in places like Hong Kong, Shanghai. There's actually now a group in of Chinese members in Beijing, which was just so gratifying to hear. That would have been impossible 10 or 15 years ago. There's, you know, a group that has Chinese-speaking members in Shanghai, and I think a couple in Hong Kong. So slow, yes, but not impossible. And I guess that's kind of the message about China. It's very slow, but not impossible.